you happen to take questions about this or any of the other stuff I've written about, you've had your hand up for a while, so go ahead.
No, it's not a question, it's just a comment. I remember when we had Julian Simon speak.
Oh, really?
Years ago. You're talking money to the guy.
That's one of the more flattering things you could say.
I'm very happy to meet him, and what you're saying, Harold Smith, great to you.
Great. Mencken has never spoken to you, has he? My other hero. So. Yes, in the back there, and then I'll...
First of all, I'd like to thank you for having me for this.
Sure.
I think we're hearing the need to more than you said to the people who are well. Allow me just to share an observation. One of the great things about this schedule is the information flow is coming so much more expensive, so I think it will help us dealing with one of the last remaining bastions of the state, and that is education. Mm-hmm. The extent to which we are going to be, people will be able to, in effect, structure their own education at a very low cost. There will be justification for communities and scholars on this scale, for example. It is kind of hard for everyone to have their own little atom smasher or anything like that. However, the extent to which we are going to be able to deliver a very high quality education, much better than what they're getting in the traditional curriculum order. I think it's going to be remarkably liberating for us, and given the extent to which, at least at the local level, so much of our hardware as well is confiscated for the purposes of the great city of education, I see this as a tremendously liberating thing. It also allows us to remove the extraordinary things that the state has to plug the
confiscated. Yeah, I don't write a lot about education because even as someone who covers criminal justice, it's just too depressing. But, I mean, one thing that I think as libertarians we're really bad at, when I was talking about this earlier tonight at the table, is we're great at charts and graphs and regression analyses. We're really bad at putting human faces on stories, and we lose ground to people like Michael Moore because they're wrong on the ideas, but they're great at telling stories. We're right on the ideas. We don't even bother telling the stories. And that's one thing I've tried to do with my work in the criminal justice system, and it's one thing that we're trying to do with Reason TV, the video website that we started. And we did this in the magazine with education. We did a little sort of a flow chart on what it takes to fire a teacher in the New York public school system. And, I mean, it's a great way of sort of, like, putting a very, making this very accessible. And I mean, as libertarians, I mean, I think we're so sure, and I say this as a fellow libertarian who loves my fellow libertarians, but we're so sure of our rightness that we don't really feel like we need to explain ourselves to people, and we don't feel like we have to sort of dumb ourselves down to actually telling stories to illustrate our points. And unfortunately, that is how things get done in the policy world. People respond to stories more than they respond to charts and graphs, and we really need to get better at that. I think education is an issue that is loaded with possibilities when it comes to telling those kinds of stories. Right here in front, yeah.
Well, first I want to say I appreciate your comment about the education. While criminals vandalize property and they abuse the human body, it takes the government's full system to brutalize the human mind. I agree with Lorenzo, Julian Simon, and it is appreciated and included in your talk very highly. There's one thing I have to ask you about. I was surprised you're indicating that Barry Schwartz's comment that free markets lead to ennui from the surface of choices is the main argument being used today against free markets. I thought the main argument being used today was global warming.
Well, I think global warming may have taken Schwartz's place, but there were about 2 or 3 years there where you could not open up a copy of The Nation without seeing some mention of Barry Schwartz. And I mean, there was this his book, the Choice Paradox, I think it was called, actually spawned a whole field of study called happiness studies, and it was this idea that wow, we're wealthier than ever, and we're still not happier. Well, I mean, how do you measure happiness? You poll people, and how do people measure their own happiness? They don't measure their own happiness they don't compare themselves to people who lived 75 years ago, right? They compare themselves to their neighbors, the people all around them. So of course, there's always going to be sort of a you know, 10% of the people are always going to be unhappy because they're the 10% of people who aren't enjoying life as much as the other 90%. But, you know, objectively, you can say that not having to worry about whether your kid is going to make it to age 5 is going to make you a happier person, you know, regardless of whether or not you regret, you know, what kind of toothbrush you bought earlier that day. But I agree with you. I mean, global warming is, I don't know if it's the chief critique of capitalism, but the proposed solutions are certainly the chief enemies or opponents of capitalism right now. Yes, right here.
One thing that I found that just been like, you know, over the last few months that converting Democrats from their old views to new views, you just talking about the existence of like rubber roofs, which is where they put the school thing just sort of in danger to keep around kids, but it's too expensive to fire them to keep them in the room secure or whatever. I mean, that's something that I found has been helping convert Democrats just by 10, 20, 12, you know, a room full of Democrats can convert about something like that. And when you talk about criminal justice, have you found, you know, similar issues that can allow you to sort of very quickly attempt to convert a room?
Yeah, I've actually had some success. I mean, obviously, when you cover criminal justice, you have a different sort of political class of opponents than when you cover education. So the people I'm trying to convince are generally conservatives. And, you know, the argument I make to conservatives, and actually I'm going to try to, I want to pitch the idea of writing this article for National Review, the sort of the conservative case for criminal justice reform. Conservatives understand the trappings of bureaucracy when it comes to, say, an EPA or FDA regulator, right? They understand public choice theory. They understand that, you know, that bureaucrats act in their own self-interest, not in the public good, no matter how much we want to pretend otherwise. They understand that, you know, giving public servants, that not punishing them, not making them not able to be fired is a huge incentive problem, like the incentive structures are all wrong. They understand this when you're talking about regulators. And what's always bizarre, and when I phrase it this way, conservatives generally have no response. So you understand that when you're talking about an FDA or an EPA regulator. You take a guy out of high school, you give him six weeks of academy training, you give him a gun and a badge and unlimited authority to not only detain people, but to use lethal force, to kill people. And conservatives argue that we're supposed to just defer to that person's judgment, that we're supposed to give him, that police officer, as little oversight as possible. That just doesn't make any sense, right? And not only with cops, but also with prosecutors. I mean, prosecutors, every incentive is for them to win as many convictions as possible. There have been 250 DNA exonerations over the last 10 or 15 years. According to the Innocence Project, about a third of those involved prosecutorial misconduct. So you have, these are cases where the prosecutor withheld exculpatory evidence, or in some cases manufactured evidence, that led to an innocent person going to prison. Anyone want to guess in how many of those cases where prosecutorial misconduct led to an innocent person going to jail? In how many of those cases was the prosecutor disciplined or sanctioned in any way?
Zero.
That's right. There is no, every incentive is toward prosecutors breaking every rule to convict someone. There is no punishment for going too far. And, I mean, conservatives understand that these are huge public choice problems when you're talking about private sector regulators, but they seem to sort of suspend all rationality and understanding of these sorts of issues when you're talking about law enforcement. And when you rephrase it to them this way and you say, you know, why do the trappings of bureaucracy just disappear when we're talking about crime, they really don't have an answer for it. So that has been an argument that I've used that has won, I think, a lot of conservatives over on those issues. Yes?
Please be honest and blunt. What
sure.
is your opinion of the Libertarian Party as an organization, and how can we improve?
Oh, man. Can I cash the check first? Or I mean, I don't think I'm going to surprise anyone in the room when I say that the LP has an image problem, right? I think that it's getting better, I think. And I think that, man, you really put me on the hot seat here. I think that libertarians sort of outside the Beltway view Cato and reason and sort of professional libertarians like myself with some skepticism. I think the critique is sometimes that we're more interested in, you know, getting invited to the right cocktail parties, I guess, than being principled. And I can say that's not at all true because I sort of hate the Washington social scene, to be honest. But I think there's a reason why libertarians who sort of get published in his ideas get taken seriously outside of libertarian circles, refer themselves as small L libertarians. And I think the Libertarian Party has for a long time, and I think they've gotten better at it, but I think for a long time kind of been a sort of a magnet for people who couldn't find a home in other mainstream political parties. And this is going to be true of any third party, I think, for a long time until they start to get some momentum. And, you know, I think the other problem with the LP is that libertarians, by their very philosophy, don't seek to acquire political power. That's not what we do, right? We want to go out and start a business and create wealth and do well by ourselves and by our families. And, man, I'm really going to risk offending some people here, but when you take all those people out of the equation, you're sort of left with people who are sort of diehards on the philosophy, but that, you know, are sort of more in it for the philosophy than, I mean, the philosophy is their life instead of the philosophy is the way they sort of guide their lives or how they think society should be ordered. I think the Libertarian Party needs to be better, again, like I said earlier, at telling stories. I think they really need to be better about weeding out candidates that are going to reflect poorly on the party and the philosophy. I think in a lot of cases the party needs to kind of understand that sometimes it may be better to not run a candidate than run one that's whose skin turned blue because he drank the silver compound. You guys know the story, right, in Montana. There's an LP candidate for the U.S. Senate who drank some sort of silver solution because he thought the government was going to try to co-opt his brain over 2000. I don't know exactly. But anyway, it turned his skin like sort of bright blue, and he became kind of like the poster child for LP kind of wackiness. And unfortunately, his blue face appeared everywhere. And it's since, you know, anytime somebody wants to marginalize libertarian ideas, they post this guy's blue faces. Michael Bednarik a few years ago, and I apologize if anyone's a fan, but, you know, some of the things he said, you know, that criminals should be chained to their beds until their muscles atrophy and they can't walk anymore. I mean, that was one of his sort of policy positions. I think the party needs to sort of look more for candidates who can express the ideas. And you know, I mean, part of it is also picking your battles, right? Let's take the issue that libertarians always get tarred with, I think, unfairly. But this idea that we're so, like, you know, for sexual liberation that we even defend pedophiles or whatever, right? Well, you know, personally, I think people who actually produce child pornography or people who prey on children, you know, should go to prison for a very long time, probably the rest of their lives. I actually have a problem with possession of child pornography, not production, or not distribution, but simple possession being a crime, because I think it gives the state too much power. For example, if you're, you know, this happened in Arizona. There's a kid who's like surfing regular straight porn sites and, you know, accidentally stumbled onto some child porn images. He had, I think, 9 of them on his computer, and they prosecuted him and tried to put him in jail for 90 years, 10 years for each photo. I think possession of child pornography should not be a crime. It's not an issue that I would go out and debate on. It's not an issue that I would put, you know, out there. It's not an issue that I would sort of prove my libertarian bona fides by saying I even think people should be allowed to have child porn on their computers, right? It's about picking your battles. Right now, you know, the Libertarian Party should be out there talking about the fact that, you know, the U.S. government is trying to hold Toyota's feet over the fire while the same government is the majority stakeholder in General Motors. I mean, that's a huge problem, right? I mean, how can we expect, you know, the government to handle this issue fairly when they own a rival company, the company that they're raking over the coals right now? I mean, these are the issues I think that the LP really needs to get out there and hammer home. And you know, I covered drug policy for 3 years at the Cato Institute. I think it's a very, very important issue, but you know, it's how you frame it. I mean, we need to talk about medical marijuana patients who are dying because they can't keep their medication down. We don't need to be sort of talking about why there should be, you know, heroin vending machines at elementary school. I'm exaggerating for effect, but it's about the issues you choose, and it's about how you frame the issues. And I think that's really what the party could stand to do better to kind of further its message. So. I'm going to go with you because you haven't answered the question. I asked the question.
Yeah,
sorry.
I was just wondering, in my doing the soil testing, I really want to make that possibly a third key issue. Something having to do with improving the criminal justice system, at least in the state of Maryland. Do you have any ideas of what could be improved there?
Well, I mean, you know, Maryland is the first state in the country that passed the SWAT team transparency bill in response to the Chi-Cala raid. And this is great. I mean, as somebody who's studied this issue for a while, we now have actual numbers we can look at how many times Maryland, and, you know, the numbers are exactly what I feared they would be, which is that Maryland's police departments are deploying SWAT teams for low-level crimes. They're, you know, sending these sort of commando units into private homes. You know, in some cases I've reported on, you know, they pull over a teenage kid and find pot in his car. And the next day, you know, next night in the middle of the night, they send the SWAT team and the kid's parents' homes, you know, in the middle of the night. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that the LP can be shouting from the rooftops and have people. I mean, this isn't even legalizing marijuana. This is saying the drug war has gone so ridiculously damn far that they're sending commando units into your house at 3 in the morning because they caught your kid with a bag of pot. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that gets people angry. And I think that's you know, the kind of issues that I think, the kind of criminal justice issues I think that will resonate with people. And, you know, Calvo, because, you know, it was fortunate for this issue that it happened to him, and I've told him this, and he's okay with me saying that, because, you know, he's credible. And he realized, to his credit, I mean, the guy's really an amazing person. He immediately realized that I'm a mayor, I'm white, I'm upper middle class. You know, all my neighbors know I'm innocent. You know, this distinguishes me from 95% of the people that these raids happen to who are innocent. And immediately realized that, and he's, you know, sort of championed the cause ever since. So, I mean, the few times Calvo has spoken at libertarian events, he's been sort of cornered and by activists who demand that he denounce, you know, that he say he's for legalizing crack tomorrow, unfortunately. So I think he's sort of turned off by the libertarian stuff just because he's been given the litmus tests already. You know, if you can champion some of these issues that he wants, which is, you know, I mean, it's such common sense stuff. I mean, the state delegate from Prince George's County, for example, introduced a bill saying that it should be illegal for a police department to send a SWAT team for a misdemeanor crime, right? I mean, how that is sort of duh, right? Opposed by every police organization in the state. They want to be able to send SWAT teams whenever they want, apparently for, you know, not paying your parking ticket, apparently. That's an issue. You could say, you know, why in the world should they be able to send a SWAT team for, you know, a misdemeanor crime? You know, that happens to be my pet issue, so, you know, you can take that for what it's worth. You know, generally speaking, I do think that public opinion on criminal justice issues is turning. I think we've had 4 years of Get Tough on Crime. We now have the world's highest incarceration rate, which, you know, you need to sort of take, put in context. I mean, you could argue that everyone in North Korea, for example, is in a prison of some sort. But, you know, by far and away, the U.S. has the highest proportion of its population behind bars than any other developed country. It's time. John DiIulio, who's one of the biggest names in cultural conservatism and sort of Get Tough on Crime, actually this week came out in favor of legalizing marijuana. The tide is really shifting on this issue, and I think, particularly in a state like Maryland, which I think is sort of more center left and more center right, that's probably an issue where you can get some traction. Does Maryland have a medical marijuana law? Is there a decriminalization bill working its way through the? There is. Okay. I mean, maybe it's sort of a cliche to have the LP candidate talking about legalizing marijuana, but and, you know, if you talk about it in terms of the toll that it takes, you know, I'm assuming like every other state, Maryland's running a budget deficit. You know, talk about how much it costs to prosecute your typical marijuana offender and say, you know, is it really worth paying this much money to go after this person who's really not harming anyone and is ingesting something that's no more, you know, at the very least, no more harmful than alcohol. And a lot of states are doing this. A lot of states are turning to drug courts. They're looking at decriminalizing marijuana because, this is why alcohol prohibition ended. It's not because the government suddenly decided that people should be able to, you know, do what they want in terms of ingesting spirits. Alcohol prohibition was lifted because we went into a depression and the federal government wanted the money that they could get from liquor taxes. That's what sort of spurred the 21st Amendment. So I think that's what we're seeing with marijuana. I mean, California is now looking at decriminalizing because they have a huge budget deficit and they want to tax it. So, you know, as a libertarian, I have sort of somewhat mixed feelings about that, you know, saying we should legalize it so it can be taxed so the government can have more money, but it's certainly preferable to kicking in doors in the middle of the night and shooting dogs and throwing people in prison. So.
What was your second point? We got the, of the top four that people have voted,
well, the number one was legalizing marijuana, the second one was the incarceration rate.
Okay.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the other one was
online
gambling, yeah, which actually is working great. I actually played some online poker before I came. not very good, but I enjoy it. Yes? Yeah, the question was, what's the status of the Corey May case? Let me just very briefly give you a summary of what happened in that case. This was in day after Christmas 2001 in Prentice, Mississippi. The police got a tip from a confidential informant, who I'll tell you about in a second, that there was this guy, Jamie Smith, was selling drugs out of his house. Well, Smith lived in a duplex, and next to him in this duplex there lived at the time, 21-year-old black man, Corey May, his girlfriend, Shantia Lagineau, and their 18-month-old daughter. The police, the officer in the case, Ron Jones Jr., put together this sort of ad hoc SWAT team. They actually had a regular SWAT team, but because it was the holidays, I guess he couldn't get them together. So he put together this ad hoc team and conducts the raid on thinking it's Jamie Smith's house. Ends up raiding both sides of the duplex. So Corey May, no prior criminal record, had basically a burnt roach in the house, which would have gotten, you know, a $50 fine under any other circumstances. You know, was not a drug dealer by any stretch of the imagination. The police wakes up in the middle of the night. The police are banging on his door. He says he didn't realize they were police, and I believe him. Runs to the back bedroom where his daughter is. He has a handgun. Lays on the floor next to his daughter with a gun, sort of hoping the noises will go away. He had just moved into this neighborhood about, I think, 6 weeks earlier. And, you know, it's kind of a rough neighborhood, lived next to a drug dealer. So the noises come around to the back, the bedroom door flies open. Officer Ron Jones, who's dressed all in black, actually, not wearing a police uniform, runs in. Corey fires his gun three times. One of the bullets hits Jones, and the officer dies on the way to the hospital. Make matters worse, Jones was white, Corey May is black. Jones was also the son of the town police chief, and this was all in Jefferson Davis County, Mississippi, which is sort of, as you might guess by the name, is a place where, I mean, I've been down there several times, and where race is not only sort of still a factor, it's like it's a suffocating part of everyday life. I mean, it is... it's still being sort of, the Civil War is still being replayed down there. It's awful. But anyway, so Corey was convicted of capital murder, which is the knowing intentional killing of a police officer, and sentenced to death. And so I started writing about his case in 2005, and it generated some momentum, I guess, on the internet, on the blogs. and the Covington Brewing Firm in D.C. picked up the case and gave him pro bono representation. In the fall of 2006, the judge threw out the death sentence, saying that his attorney was competent during the trial portion but incompetent during the sentencing portion, which is sort of puzzling. But so he threw out the death sentence and ordered a new one. The state agreed not to to just agree to life without parole, which is where it stood until November of last year, when the Mississippi Court of Appeals granted Corey a new trial. So basically, there are some kind of perfunctory steps they have to go through. So the state's going to appeal to the state Supreme Court, which could potentially overturn the Court of Appeals, but it's unlikely. So probably what's going to happen is Corey's going to get a new trial in Jefferson Davis County, which is not where the original trial took place. It took place in a much whiter, more conservative county. Probably later, late summer, early fall of this year. And, you know, there's reason for cautious optimism, I think, because if he gets tried in Jeff Davis County, you know, everybody knows his name, everybody knows what's happened. And, you know, to be sort of crude about it, and unfortunately this is a part of the criminal justice system, you know, Jeff Davis County is 70% black, so he's going to have a majority black jury, which means, you know, at most, you know, he's going to get a hung jury. It really is hard to see him being convicted in Jefferson Davis County. But this really sort of, this case really came to epitomize the work that I've done on these drug raids, because here you had this guy who had no criminal record, was all, by all accounts, a very gentle, almost timid guy. And in fact, you know, the real kind of sad irony in this is, you know, black men in Mississippi are often criticized for, you know, not sort of taking care of their children, abandoning their children. And Corey was really a guy who took care of his kids, and in fact, he, you know, he was not well educated, and when he wasn't working, in Mississippi, most black men who don't have, you know, a college degree, work in construction, and during the rainy season, there's just not much work. And when he wasn't working, he stayed home and took care of the kids while his wife worked at she had a job at a chicken processing plant. And, you know, by all accounts, even Corey's the mother of the daughter. So this is the, to put it crudely, the mother of the woman Corey knocked up outside of marriage defended him, like said he was like the greatest father to the kids she could ever imagine. And so here you have this guy who was a great father to his kids and who was defending his daughter that night from what he thought were criminal intruders, gets, you know, taken away from his kids and put in prison. And, you know, his kids have sort of drifted out of his life since then. You know, I mean, you can sort of understand the mother not, you know, not wanting the kids to, their own, you know, the only father they know to be on death row. But, as I said, so we're sort of optimistic at this point. There's going to be a new trial, most likely. And it seems like, you know, he has a good shot at an acquittal. The idea that, you know, a guy with no record would look outside of his window and see a team of raiding police officers, despite having nothing incriminating in his house, decide he was going to shoot and kill just one of them and then surrender with bullets still left in his gun, I mean, it just defies all credulity, right? I mean, the much more likely explanation for his actions that night were he didn't know it was a cop, and as soon as he found out it was a cop, he gave up and surrendered. So that's kind of the gist of the story. If you're interested in the story, if you go to Reason TV, we did a 30-minute documentary on Corey's case that will probably make you weep, but I think is a really good sort of outline of what happened. I told you I'd tell you about the informant. The informant in the case, this is the guy who the police used in countless raids down there, mostly against African Americans, and who was repeatedly described on search warrants as a trustworthy and reliable informant. About 2 years after I started writing on the case, the Covington and Burling law firm hired a private investigator who found the informant. Interestingly, the prosecution said all along they had no idea who the informant was and will never know because only Ron Jones knew who the informant was, and he's dead, so don't even try looking for him. Well, they've hired this private investigator, and it took them all about a day to find the informant. Basically, he looked at the autopsy photos, and Officer Jones had a phone number written on his hand in the photos, and he called that number, and the informant answered the phone. So the private investigator went out and interviewed this guy, and I guess, I mean, the guy The guy was like let me preface this by saying I actually love the people of Mississippi. I'm not crazy about the criminal justice system, but I've spent a lot of time down there, and the people of Mississippi are great. This guy was right out of Central Casting, if you wanted like the cliched sort of redneck Mississippian. He talks to the private investigator. The guy's not that smart, and he, I guess he doesn't realize that this is a private investigator working for Corey's legal team. So they have this conversation where the guy tells him everything. Tells him, you know, yeah, oh yeah, I was the informant, yeah, blah, blah. And so the investigator then gives him the card of one of Corey's attorneys, and he gave him the card of actually the local attorney who's working with Corey's case, this guy Bob Evans. And at this point, the informant's name is Randy Gentry. He gives Randy Gentry the card, and he looks at it, and he realizes he just spilled the beans to, like, the defense team. Again, guy's not that bright. He calls the Bob Evans number, gets Evans' answering machine, leaves we've provided this recording in the documentary with a transcript for you. Leaves this about minute long message on Evans' answering machine where, drops the N bomb multiple times. You know, says, I'll be damned if I'm going to help some N get out of jail. I'm a white man and I care about the white race. And I mean, it just goes on. And this is the guy that the police use as their trustworthy, reliable informant in, you know, dozens and dozens of drug raids down there on African Americans. It shows you just how ugly the drug war is, right? I mean, the informants, I could talk for an hour. I have talked for an hour on the informant issue. But the idea that you're using these people that you're using the word of these people who, you know, as soon as they're exposed, the police will distance themselves from it and say, well, you can't trust him. He's a slimy drug user. Well, you trusted him on all these warrants you served for the last 10 years. You know, now that he's saying something critical of you, you're telling us what an awful person he is. But it's a whole other subject, so sorry. anything else? I'm happy to. Yeah.
Do
the prosecutors and the cops who get involved in these things, do they show any reticence whatsoever
about what they cost?
No. In Corey's case, I think it really depends on where you're from. I mean, there are cases where, I mean, there are good prosecutors and good cops out there. It's hard to tell in Corey's case. I mean, Mississippi, maybe it's the South in general, but there's sort of a different culture there. The prosecutor in Corey's case, this guy Claiborne, Buddy McDonald, after I just started writing about Corey's case, he emailed me. I guess he saw I worked for the Cato Institute and thought I was a conservative, so if he told me these things about Corey, it would change my mind about the case. But he emailed me as soon as Glenn Reynolds, who runs a very high traffic blog called InstaFund, linked to my writing about Corey's case, and from there it just sort of exploded. And I guess it got word got down there that somebody was writing about this case, and Buddy sends me an email, and I guess he just thought, you know, well, this guy works for Cato, he must be conservative. If I just tell him that Corey had a tattoo, then certainly he'll agree with me that he was guilty in all this and meant to kill a cop, because, you know, anyone who would get a tattoo was obviously a cop killer. So he sends me this email letting me know that Corey has a tattoo. Of course, I saw this as an opening, so I sent him a big, long list of questions, and remarkably, he answered all of them. I asked him the question I just posed earlier, you know, why would this guy decide to take on a team of raiding cops, kill just one of them, and surrender? And his answer was, well, sometimes people do irrational things. But what was weird is when I went down for the hearing where they threw out the death sentence, yeah, I mean, it was hard. I saw Ron Jones' family, his parents down there, and, you know, they were clearly, you know, torn up and were reliving all of this. But you know, after the trial, or after the hearing, one thing Bob Evans, Corey's Mississippi lawyer, told me, he said, you know, one thing about Buddy is he'll hate you when he thinks he's winning, but when he thinks that he's going to lose, he'll become like your best friend. And after the hearing, he came up and introduced himself to me and shook my hand and, you know, said, Bradley thinks I hate him. I don't hate him. You know, if it weren't for the pot and and opposing the wars, I'd be one of them libertarians too. And he said, you know, I'm retiring next year, and I'm going to open my own practice, and you know, I'll probably defend people like Corey next year. And I was like, you're trying to kill him, you know, like maybe that's more of a larger thing than this other thing, but the idea that you could sort of switch from wanting to kill someone to wanting to defend them, you know, based on who's paying your paycheck, just kind of blew my mind. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can help the Governor of Ideals contact the mayor of Sterling, Maryland. You already explained that he's had some questions from me to some of the things, but these people are not like that. And I think it would be good for him encouraging things to go to.
Sure. Yep. I'll give you a card after I'm done. And I mean, I've worked a lot with Mayor Calvo, and I said I think he's a really, really impressive person. Actually, I hope he runs for county executive down there, because they need someone sensible in that position. But I think his impression of I think his impression of libertarians is still that we're crazy, but I think it's gone from bad crazy to kind of a lovable, kind of good crazy. So, yeah. But I think we're making progress with him. I did get him to admit to me off the record, which means I probably shouldn't be saying this, but that he would end the federal drug war. That he's, you know, he's not ready to say we should. He's not ready to make sort of the Ninth Amendment case for drug use, but that the, you know, federalizing the issue, bringing it back to the states is probably the wisest course of action.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be a question of his endorsing them, but it's more of his feeding them information.
Absolutely, and giving them ideas on reform and so forth.
Educational.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think I think he would welcome that. Anyone else? Okay. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I hope you had a good time. I did, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye. 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 Bye.